has a good working knowledge of everything from economic development to engineering to transportation to commercial fishing.
Governor Parnell appoints a replacement for former Juneau lawmaker Beth Kurtula. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage School Board finds some compromise and passes a budget.
So that this board can dedicate its energies to supporting this administration to make those innovations that are required, that are needed in our global economy.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Governor Sean Parnell today appointed civil engineer and legislative lobbyist Sam Keto III to fill the House District 32 seat vacated last month by Juneau Representative Beth Kurtula. In a news conference this morning, Parnell said he picked Keto for his vision, knowledge of district communities, and statewide experience.
Has a good working knowledge of everything from economic development to engineering to transportation to commercial fishing. I mean, quite a wide range of experience across the state.
Keto is currently lobbying the legislature for an engineering firm and his family's lobbying firm, which has tourism, healthcare, and fish processing contracts, as well as telecommunications firm GCI. He says he will terminate his contracts if he's confirmed by House Democrats. Keto was one of three Juneau Democrats nominated for the seat by local party officials after public interviews. Parnell passed over Juneau Assemblymember Jesse Keel, an aide to Juneau Senator Dennis Egan, and Catherine Reardon, an administrative aide to Anchorage Representative Andy Josephson. The governor has asked House Democrats to vote to confirm Keto on the floor. On the House floor rather than in closed caucus. Democrats are not expected to determine until Monday which confirmation process they will use. Keto hasn't always been a Democrat. He said he switched his voter registration from nonpartisan to Democrat in about 2004. Over the years, he's contributed to a number of Republican campaigns. If he's confirmed, Keto said his first priority is to make sure the state library archives and museum facility can be completed. The project still needs about $37 million. Keto also says he's concerned about the state's economy.
With declining oil revenues, with large mega projects out there that may or may not bring in significant revenue, and trying to look past that fiscal chasm to where everybody in Alaska doesn't have to worry about, are we going to have high enough oil prices or enough production, a balanced economy, a diversified economy. I'm looking forward to that future where we can have a stable economy.
Unlike Kurtula, who held the seat for 15 years, Keto would not say how he'll vote on a referendum to roll back the state's current oil tax law passed by the legislature last year. He said he needs to do more research on the issue. Kurtula voted against the legislation last year and has campaigned to convince voters to reject the new law when it comes up for a statewide vote in August. The former House Minority Leader resigned her seat on January 24th to take a fellowship at Stanford University. An analysis of what would be the first commercial development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, is the subject of a report issued by the Bureau of Land Management. BLM spokeswoman K.J. Muscovich says the document considers an oil and gas drilling project application submitted by ConocoPhillips, Alaska.
ConocoPhillips, Alaska submitted an application for a right-of-way grant and related authorizations to construct a drill site, an approximately 8-mile access road, above-ground elevated pipelines, and an electric power line connecting the drill pad to Conoco's CD5 drill pad that's currently under development.
The nearly 12-acre drill pad is in the Greater Moose's Tooth Unit on BLM-managed land. It's about 17 miles west of ConocoPhillips' existing Alpine oil field, which is on state land. A 60-day comment period begins today and includes several public meetings. After weeks of number crunching, the Anchorage School Board unanimously passed a budget last night that cuts $23 million and 200 positions. Nearly 150 of those are teaching positions in middle and grade schools. More than a dozen people testified. Then the board made small changes at the high school level that will make a big difference to the community. KSK's Daisha Eaton has more.
High schools will maintain a 6-period school day instead of going to 7 periods, something student and parent groups had been fighting for. The board also made amendments that added 16 teachers and 3 counseling positions back into the budget that had previously been on the chopping block. But they had to dig into their savings to do it, suspending a longtime policy that ensured the board keep a minimum of 8% of funds in the bank. None of the school board members seemed happy about having to tap into reserve funds, especially the chair, Tam Agosti-Giesler.
I'm hoping that we can get beyond this funding crisis and find solutions in this state to do what we are constitutionally mandated to do, and that is to fund education, so that this board can dedicate its energies to supporting this administration to make those innovations that are required, that are needed in our global economy.
The 16 teaching positions spared will be for classes helping students at risk of not graduating. The 3 counseling positions saved will likely be English language learner counselors. The board still plans to cut 200 positions, including 17 teachers and 5 counselors. The Anchorage School District 2014-2015 budget is $743.5 million, slightly less than last year's. The budget now goes to the Anchorage Assembly for approval. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Macoriac residents want more muskox hunting access.
The way it stands now, they're favoring a commercial enterprise over subsistence way of living.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority would like to recognize businesses and organizations that employ Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a mental health trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job, you're providing an opportunity to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Secretary of State John Kerry announced last week that he's creating a new position called Special Representative for the Arctic Region. It's been referred to as an Arctic ambassador in some reports, but it's not exactly that, and the reaction of Alaska's 2 U.S. senators has been mixed. On the phone to talk to us about what it is APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent Liz Ruskin. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Lori.
So, Liz, both senators have been pressing for an Arctic ambassador to assert the U.S. interests in the region. Shouldn't this be unbridled good news to the senators?
Well, it was the way Senator Begich announced it last week on Valentine's Day. He talked to Kerry on the phone and then issued a press release that used the word ambassador a dozen times.
But Senator Murkowski doesn't see it that way. Is that a correct characterization?
Yeah, that's right. A few hours later, her press release came out, and she pointed out the Secretary of State never used the word ambassador in a letter he wrote to both senators. Murkowski questioned whether the position would be on par, and she used some harsh language. She called the Obama administration's Arctic policy lackluster and a national disgrace.
So, Liz, is this just the Washington dance where the senator of one party is obligated to criticize the president when he's of the opposite party?
Could be some of that. It's also a turf battle between the 2 Senate offices.
Well, explain that for us. What do you mean?
Well, it doesn't take much reading between the lines of the press releases to see that Murkowski's office was ticked. The Secretary of State called Begich and allowed him to break the news. That was kind of a gift. In her press release, Murkowski's staff wrote that she is considered the leading expert on Arctic issues in Congress. And they back that up with pictures of her posing with the chair of the Arctic Council this month and sitting right next to Secretary Kerry at an Arctic confab in Sweden last year. The press release even included a video of her talking Arctic on the Senate floor back in 2011, and she's gesturing to a map of the Arctic, no less. And altogether, the not-so-subtle message is the Arctic is her terrain.
Back to the terminology, special representative or ambassador, does it matter?
Well, it does if you ask Senator Murkowski. She issued a press release just yesterday suggesting this Arctic rep thing is window dressing because the person wouldn't have the same standing as the real Arctic ambassadors from other countries. She says Secretary Kerry should meet with her and explain why he refuses to upgrade to ambassador. And Begich, on the other hand, told me today this is a step toward creating an Arctic ambassador, which would require Senate confirmation.
Liz, is he saying it was wrong to use the word ambassador in his press release last week?
Oh, not at all. He insists he'll call the appointee ambassador because he or she will be acting in that role.
All right, Liz, thanks for giving us that clarity on this new position.
Thanks, Lori.
APRN's Liz Ruskin speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Alaska's mayors and other local officials are worried their governments may be asked to pay more toward public employees' retirement. The lobbying group Alaska Municipal League is backing Governor Sean Parnell's proposal to use $3 billion in savings to reduce an estimated $12 billion shortfall in state pension funds. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Alaska communities and the state share the costs of the public employees' retirement system. Municipalities pay 22% of their payroll into PERS each year. Some also pay 12.5% into the teachers' retirement system. The state pays the rest of what's needed to cover pensions in a particular year. That amount is determined by actuaries and set annually by the Alaska Retirement Management Board. Kathy Wasserman is executive director of the Alaska Municipal League.
Certainly, it's a good enough chunk that municipalities cannot afford for that to go up.
If nothing is done to address the PERS shortfall, Wasserman fears the local contribution could increase to 40% of payroll. She says the governor's plan to transfer $3 billion from the Constitutional Budget Reserve to the retirement system would maintain the rate at 22% until the funds are solvent, whenever that might be.
We really can't define how many years because it's based on interest rates, based on the market, it's based on, you know, baby boomers, when people die. There's a lot of variability in that. But 22% right now we can plan for.
Kodiak Mayor Pat Branson says local communities need predictability.
If we keep it at those percentages, we're not going to be able to do business and keep our infrastructure in place, keep police and fire operating, schools open, that kind of thing.
The Parnell administration estimates its proposal would reduce the state's annual payment to PERS and TERS. Without the cash infusion, the governor's office says the state would soon pay more than $1 billion a year toward the pension shortfall. Deputy Administration Commissioner Mike Barnhill told the Alaska Municipal League that doing nothing is not appealing.
If the governor's approach doesn't pass, the status quo will persist. We will continue to make actuarially required contributions, however they're calculated.
The governor's plan is part of his proposed operating budget. Many states and communities in the lower 48 have faced even bigger pension problems, leading to bankruptcies and cuts to retirement payments. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Residents of Mikoriuk on Nunavak Island are seeking more involvement and more muskox harvest. This is happening as the 20-year-old agreement that guides management is set to undergo changes. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The harvest of muskoxen is currently split between a registration hunt for cows and a costly permit lottery for bulls that's largely utilized by out-of-town sport hunters led by local guides. Managers have issued just 5 cows for the local registration hunt over the past 3 years and have given out 30 or more bull permits that mostly go to outsiders. Mikoriuk's Dale Smith spoke at a recent meeting in Bethel with state and federal managers.
The way it stands now, they're favoring of a commercial enterprise over subsistence way of living. And it was evident when they voted on that in early January. So of all the things we discussed, the main issue is subsistence priority. And that's our stance right now.
82 people signed a petition asking for an allocation of more muskoxen for McCormick residents. They're seeking 30 more muskoxen, which will be taken from the outside permit hunt. In efforts to become more active in management, members of McCormick's Tribal Council have formed a federally recognized tribal conservation district through the USDA. This program allows groups to take a part in managing natural resources and establishing conservation priorities. They can seek funding and build partnerships with other agencies. They unsuccessfully asked the Board of Game for an emergency allocation of muskoxen this January. Missing at the meeting in Bethel were the guides and transporters that earn their living working with out-of-town hunters. There are no predators on Nunavak Island, where muskoxen were first introduced back in 1936, but it's not necessarily straightforward to manage them. A 1992 agreement sets a goal of maintaining a population between 500 and 550 muskoxen. That's muskoxen alive after the hunt, but before calves are born. The island has been below that level since 2009. There were more cows harvested prior to 2010-2011, but the last few years has shown poor survival of calves. Whereas there used to be around 100 calves per year, now they're getting more like 60. The bull-to-cow ratio is also out of balance, getting as high as 138 bulls per 100 cows. Patrick Jones is a biologist with the Department of Fish and Game.
When you have that many bulls, they're probably injuring a few cows. We'd like to have that number about 80 bulls per 100 cows. And so we have the surplus of bulls, even though the population's below our objective, we have the surplus of bulls, and it's to our benefit to lower that bull-cow ratio. So we've been allowing extra bull harvest. We have it, it's available, and it's to the benefit of the population at this point.
A huge factor is the health of the food supply. The Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge does not have current data on the health of that range. The island's 1,853 reindeer eat on the same territory. The Board of Game and Federal Subsistence Board are at the end of their two-year cycles for taking up proposals, but the group does want to pursue designation of the muskox as a subsistence priority species. Managers at the meeting agreed to revise the 1992 document that sets the foundation for muskox management on the island. There will be a meeting in March on the island to discuss revisions and meet with stakeholders. I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ariel Van Cleve. This week on AK, rural recycling. The city of Nome just bought a new recycling shed online. It's another step towards diverting more waste from the landfill and either repurposing it or shipping it out of Alaska. Rural recycling presents some unique challenges for environmental management, and the city is finding some unique solutions. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes has the story.
Glenn Jones yanks on a ripcord, warming up Nome's new can crusher. Jones is the operator for Nome's landfill, and the crusher is a diesel-powered hydraulic press that was built to flatten 55-gallon steel drums down to just an inch. Now, after some tinkering, Jones has got it squeezing soda and beer cans into big squares a little over 2 feet wide.
And it'll crush down to about 4 inches deep of cans.
The Nome landfill recently set up a new recycling facility. Nothing fancy, just some big plastic totes inside of a little wooden shed. But it means residents can start dropping off a lot more stuff to be recycled.
Glass, aluminum cans, and cardboard. There's three different bays in there to sort out through it.
Cardboard is a biggie. There's more and more of it coming into Nome, partly from the steady rise in shipments brought in by the grocery stores in town. Sometimes, Jones says, a truck will drop off a load that's 3/4 cardboard. If you bury it all in a landfill, it takes up a ton of room, and it isn't cost-effective to recycle unless it's squished into super-dense bales that can be shipped out to processing facilities in the lower 48. Jones recently got some medium-sized balers up and running. The idea is to eventually put some behind the grocery stores so they can bale on site rather than trucking loads of cardboard out to the dump each day.
So we're here at the Nome City landfill, and as you can see, there's signs all over telling people where to separate their wood, their aluminum cans, glass.
Anama Saito is the regional backhaul and recycling specialist for Kuwerik, the regional nonprofit based in Nome.
Yeah, most people don't think about where their trash goes once they put it in their trash can, but we're in the business of figuring out where it goes after that and where the best place for it to go will be.
Saito's main job is coordinating with communities around the region to redirect anything that could be hazardous away from landfills and towards a staging area in Nome.
Most of them are diverting aluminum cans and plastic bottles, and then electronic waste and lead acid batteries. Those are the main items, along with fluorescent light bulbs, which contain mercury.
The idea is to get anything that's potentially hazardous out of the communities and recycle everything else. But recycling in a hub community off the road system has some, let's say, interesting challenges. For one, everything is far away, which means the fuel burned for transport often outstrips gains made from repurposing stuff. Saito says it also makes it expensive to transport old newspaper and bales of cardboard back out.
When material is brought here into Nome, it usually has a one-way ticket, and it usually will end up at the landfill or in people's yards if they're like I am.
And the small population, relatively speaking, makes operating at a large scale next to impossible. Nome is basically straddling two different recycling systems and borrowing a bit from each of them. The urban waste management strategy is to bury lots of stuff in landfills and consolidate all the reusable goods for processing at recycling facilities. It works financially because of the high volume. You can only cover costs if you're sending tons, literally tons, of cans and cardboard for reconstitution. In a region of around 10,000 people with high transport costs, that approach only goes so far. The indigenous model, by contrast, is to locally salvage everything useful, then discard the rest in a body of water. Saito says that worked when all the waste was organic.
The practice of doing that today, of course, has to change because the materials that we're using are, the majority of them are plastic.
Nome's evolving strategy is to keep everything that isn't toxic and find a use for it. Glass is the best example. We like recycling glass. It's pretty, it's heavy, and we've been taught to think of it as reusable. But, Saito says, the heft and volume in a bottle makes the carbon footprint of shipping it out huge. Plus, glass is stable, so it's not doing much harm if it's left alone in the dirt. Saito and Jones want to go a step further, though, and get a glass crusher. It would smash up bottles into smooth shards to be used like gravel, or even as decoration, because, frankly, it's kind of pretty. The point is, glass would stay in Nome and get reprocessed to do new work. Rural recycling still has a long way to go. But, Saito says, the interest is there.
Almost daily I have people asking me, you know, how come you're not recycling this material? Or how come you're not taking more of that? And really right now we're operating at full capacity. We don't really...
Like a lot of things in rural Alaska, expanded recycling is going to depend on cooperation and resourcefulness. And maybe just a few more diesel-powered hydraulic crushing machines. For AK, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're headed to Taslina. It's a small community off the Glen Allen Highway near Wrangell-St. Elias National Park.
My name is Sheila Hay. I live in Taslina, Alaska, and I'm the owner of the Aura Borealis Bed and Breakfast. The geography is Borealis forest, a lot of spruce trees and birch trees, willows. It's really beautiful. You can see the Wrangell Forest or the Wrangell National Park from where we live in the mountains. just over the river from me is what's called the Tazlina Marketplace, and they have little shops. There's a little grocery store, and then he's got hardware and a liquor store. And then you can get your hair done at Kendra's Hair Salon, and the Copper Valley Development Association is all right in that little compound. And then if you go back right over the river, the first place you'll come to is the native village of Tazlina. That's a beautiful little place, and a lot of the residents that live right in the immediate area are members of the village. I like how peaceful it is and how you get to feel part of the land. It's really calming out here. We look forward to spring coming and the runs of the salmon. The Copper River and the Klatina River are destinations for world-class fishing. And we are getting light here awfully quick. It's wonderful. And spring's on its way, so we can start getting outside more often. We have a lot of the people that work for tribal native groups here. The Otna Company, people come down, and different groups for BLM, Bureau of Land Management, Fish and Game. We're pretty broad spectrum, but we also get international travelers here. Most people are in awe of the beauty in which we get to live every day. And I tell them that it's something that I don't take for granted, that I get up every morning and say, thank you for letting me be in this place, because it's pretty special. I'm really grateful that I get to make my home in Tazlina, Alaska.
Sheila Hay owns the Aurora Borealis Bed and Breakfast in Tazlina. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Zachariah Hughes, Jolene Almendarez, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemarie Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Ben Matheson in Bethel. Ariel Van Cleve was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Doy Unlimited, announcing the 2014 annual shareholder meeting on Friday, March 14th at the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks. Information at doyon.com. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.